Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to the New Ethiopian Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the New European Podcast. My name is Richard Porritt, and I'm joined by Steve Anglesey.
Hello, Snowflakes. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm actually in my flat recording this today.
Well, that's exciting.
I know. I thought I'd come and do it from Porritt Acres. So here
Porritt
I am.
Porritt Acres.
Yeah.
I'm coming at you live from Nottingham.
Ooh, have you gone deep undercover into COVID Central?
I'm undercover in tier two.
Under the covers.
From tier three.
What's the feeling like up there, actually, interestingly? Because I spend most of my time all my time, in actual fact, in the east of England currently. And obviously we're still in tier, I get these mixed up, one.
Tier one, yeah.
The lowest level of alert. What's the feeling in Nottingham?
I would say there is some trepidation. The city centre is a lot quieter than normal, and where we are, which is out in the not quite in the suburbs, it's just out of town. The local pub has closed of its own volition,
right,
for a few weeks while they try and work out how to make things pay. There's a fair bit of trepidation, as I can imagine there is across the country, and people listening to this now will be experiencing these kind of things. We are in sort of uncertain times, aren't we? And the stuff that was announced by Rishi Sunak on Thursday seems to indicate that the extra help for the hospitality industry and stuff like that seems to indicate that we are going to be in, there's not a rosy ending in sight, is there, basically?
Do you think anywhere is going to stay out of a sort of full lockdown, or do you think we're all headed the same way?
Well, I'm coming back to Norwich.
You're escaping.
<the weekend. laughs> look, anywhere that's got a student population you can see that the cases are rising everywhere in the country, aren't they? Regardless of what is going to happen, anywhere with a large student population is rising larger than anywhere. It seems to be rising larger than anywhere else. The schools going, having children at school has certainly had some impact, hasn't it? I mean, there are much more learned places to talk about this stuff than this podcast. But it does, seem to me that, the argument now appears to be about the severity of the measures rather than whether this is a real problem and we need to, either keep stuff open or whatever. I mean, we need to, we need to have a proper national strategy, I think, about this.
The direction of travel is fairly clear, isn't it, I think, for everyone. I mean, I am supportive.
It's a nice upbeat start to the podcast. With people.
We might as well get this out of the way now before we get sort of jump headlong into the news and beyond, because obviously the Chancellor's revised scheme, I think, is necessary, because I wrote a piece yesterday saying actually, you know, our business is better off in tier three than tier two.
Well, it seems to me that they have been better off in tier three than tier two. And then, the weird stuff about, you know, I've never been to the Caprice in London, so I don't know. So I don't know how I've managed to get on the Caprice's mailing list, but I got
is it Caprice the restaurant or is it Caprice the model?
Caprice, yeah, no, it's Caprice the restaurant. I've never been to either Caprice the model or Caprice the restaurant.
Didn't she date Tony Adams?
I think she did, didn't she? And Caprice the restaurant was Paul Raymond, I think I'm right in saying that Paul Raymond, the sort of the porn baron of Soho, used to live upstairs from the Caprice, and once made on the day that Princess Margaret died, he made a memorable appearance on the shop floor. He came down in his dressing gown with a hairnet on to tell people to shut up and show some respect. He was a massive royalist, was Paul Raymond. But yeah, he lived above the Caprice. But I got a weird email from the Caprice saying, don't worry, you can still come for dinner here with people who don't live in your household. Just say, it basically said, as long as it's a business meeting, nudge nudge and all of that, you'll be fine.
Wow.
So there's very, you know, it's the bizarre sort of
loophole. See you down the Caprice.
So we're all going down the Caprice for a business meeting.
Do you know what? We should record the pod in the Caprice next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming at you live from the Caprice with Caprice.
With Caprice. Yeah. Wow. That'd be great. Well, I mean, I haven't fully digested exactly what the revised scheme. I think it looks like employers are going to pay less in tier two and staff come at fewer hours. It's fairly big stuff, but I haven't fully digested it yet. But I think we have to welcome any of these measures that support business, of course.
I mean, I think the message of it is that the employees aren't going to get any more money, but the government is going to pay for more of it than they were previously going to pay.
Yeah, so yeah. It's because I wonder if
the news for employers, not rather than employees.
Please, yeah. I think it feels to me. I was looking at the graphs from the press conference, which was on Tuesday evening. I think I was looking at the graphs and stuff that Number 10 send out. Which are beautiful. I love a graph, and they are beautiful, if not harrowing at the same time. But and it does seem that the rate of infections is going up in younger people, which would make sense, university, schools, etc. But obviously, the rate of deaths is not as high, and obviously, every single death, absolute tragedy. You know, that kind of goes without saying. But I do wonder if the second wave is going to be even more about the economic impact than the first wave was.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think so. And I think that fuels a lot of the arguments, doesn't it? And whether then also the sort of the non-COVID deaths that are caused by, GPs not seeing people, et cetera, hospitals not admitting as many people being reluctant to go to A&E, as we found out.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, anyway, there we go. That was the bit of breaking news, or broken news. We will do some more news immediately. And then we've got two special guests, I think, haven't we, Steve? Tell us about our guests.
We've got Charlie Connolly.
Love Charlie.
To Matt Withers. Charlie is the new European newspapers. He's our literary correspondent, but he's our book correspondent, really. He's an author, he's a podcaster, a fantastic guy. Also, he writes the Great European Lives section in the back of the New European, which I know is a lot of people's favourite bit of the New European.
I'll tell you a little story about Charlie, right? I love Charlie to bits.
I think my column is the best bit. Which
I love Charlie to bits. I love reading his stuff. He's beloved in our office and he's been with the New European for a long time. There was one time when current editor Jesper Coppin was off and I was basically in charge of putting the paper together, so commissioning stuff. And Charlie sends a list of Great European Lives through and he says, you know, which one do you think? And I was in a mad rush doing something like really like up against it for whatever reason. And I looked down this list and I saw the word Ferrari. And I said, oh, do Ferrari. That'll be great. Everyone will love that. And he went, yeah, I thought that'd be good as well. A bit quirky. And I thought, well, I don't know why he thinks he's quirky anyway. And then he filed his Great European Lives. And it was a brilliant piece on Lola Ferrari that you might remember her from Euro Trash. And it wasn't what we were expecting. Let's put it like that. It wasn't what the normal Great European Lives are. Great art, great literary characters or artists or whatever. And then we had Lola Ferrari, but it was a brilliant piece. And then we've got Liz Gerrard as well. So Liz Gerrard will be with us, and she's going to talk about one of the great phenomenons of this year so far. And there've been plenty of them. The rise of the Daily Star, which is really ripping up trees, in my opinion. And I love talking about tabloid newspapers. So we can expect some interesting chat there about the Daily Star, who is, which I'm sure you've all seen their fantastic Dominic Cummings cutout mask. In fact, if you've got one, put it on now and tweet us a picture of it. And then we will, of course, crown a Brexiteer of the Week after we've done all that, after Matt Withers has spoken to Charlie. So should we jump into the news first of all, Steve?
Well, we should talk about the trade talk, shouldn't we? Which, yeah. I mean, obviously we sort of said last week we appeared to have taken our ball home and all of that. And we sort of said, you know, it's another self-imposed Boris Johnson deadline, which Boris Johnson is going to have to miss. And sure enough, intensive talks starting again. There is, of course, the usual pathetic attempt by the Brexiteers to say that this is a cave-in by the EU, and little more pathetic than Jacob Rees-Mogg at the best of times. But Jacob Rees-Mogg saying that Michel Barnier has decided he might come and talk to us on Trafalgar Day, which seems to have a certain historic resonance. I mean, these are, you know, I would like there to be, I would, you know, we desperately need a trade deal, and the EU desperately needs some kind of trade deal as well. Let's not beat around the bush, but let's not portray this as as some kind of great patriotic victory, as people like David Frost and Jacob Rees-Mogg are trying. Another fake deadline. You know, the real deadline, as I think we said before, is going to be in, I think it's the 15th of November, mid-November. That is when, you know, if we haven't got a deal by then we won't be able to, you know, whatever is settled won't be able to go through the EU Parliament and our Parliament in time. So something needs to be done by the 15th of November. If it isn't done by then, I still think there'll be some kind of memorandum or something, won't there? Some yes. kind of general agreement that we can sort of shout about, and then they'll start negotiating again.
Encouraged, a little bit more encouraged this week than you were last week or the week before. Do you think that this is a sort of move towards more sort of sensible, not rhetoric, but a more sensible position on both sides?
Well, when you hear the number 10 spokesman saying the deal is definitely dead, you know, there's no chance of a deal, which I think was said on Wednesday or Thursday last week. Then you do start to worry. I'm sure that something will happen. What's interesting now, though, is that the remnants of the Brexit Party and the some of the ERG are now on manoeuvres, aren't they? And you just wonder what a reaction. I mean, I was reading something in the Telegraph by Alexandra Phillips, the former MEP, extremely hardline. Member of the Brexit Party, who was suggesting that this was all a great betrayal and Boris Johnson was about to stitch up Brexiteers. Maybe that will start to raise its ugly head once more. We must wait and see. But I think it is. I think something will happen. Mm. I think something will happen. It's just whether Boris Johnson has got the guts to face down people like Dominic Cummings and face down people like Nigel Farage. Who knows?
I guess, I mean, it seems to me that number 10's negotiating strategy is quite similar with the North, as we'll get onto that a little bit later, as it is with the EU.
Yeah, well, it is. Yeah, I mean, this is part of the problem, isn't it? That the government face. So we can talk about this because I know we're going to talk about Andy Burnham in a minute, but probably after we speak to Liz. But I just think that the government are at war constantly.
Yeah,
as Donald Trump has been during his 4 years, and it just gets extremely wearing after a while, doesn't it? I think that a constant state of war is wearing on your own troops as well as other troops.
Do you know what, though?
There is just conflict.
But it's a tried and tested and often successful political strategy. Everyone needs a bogeyman. Every politician needs a bogeyman. It's a real American political trope, isn't it? They find someone. Every president will find some evil foreign leader who's desperately trying to take over the world, even if that threat is just a perceived threat is good for votes, I'm afraid.
Well, that's true, but I mean, in the case of
our government, it's anything that moves is our enemy.
Well, it's the BBC, it's the church, it's the civil service, it's, you know,
the new European podcast.
Manchester United footballers. it's just everybody, isn't it? And okay, Donald Trump might win re-election again. I'm touching a large lump of wooden desks as I say that, but he might well win it again. But the fact is that, you know, he was at war with everybody for the first 2 years, and then at the first chance that that Americans had to vote against him, they voted against him quite, and made his life extremely difficult. And the last year and a half, he's been completely neutralised. And I think that, look, we've not got long now until the Scottish elections. We've not got long now until the next lot of local elections and a constant state of war. I don't think is a particularly good thing.
Which other political movement famously was at constant war?
Well, let's not go down there. I tell you what is weird is doing this without knowing what happened at the, because you're listening to this on Friday or over the weekend, and we're recording it on Thursday, so we don't know what happened during the presidential debate, which of course was on the last presidential debate, which was on Thursday night.
Well, what I will tell you is what I can absolutely guarantee is that, and I as well scoff at everyone, whatever side of politics they're from, bringing up Orwell's great novel, of course. But there'll be more than 2 minutes of hate, won't there, at the presidential debate? There'll be more like an hour,
absolutely. I think. Absolutely. If you've been watching the Trump documentary that's on the iPlayer now and was on BBC Two, you'll know that, you know, Rudy Giuliani takes a huge amount of credit. He gives himself a huge amount of credit for a stunt that he pulled during the last debate with Hillary Clinton, where women who'd accused Bill Clinton of various misdemeanors were invited to the debate, and the idea was this would neutralise the negative impact of the tape of Trump talking about grabbing women by their genitalia and stuff like that, which really should have seen him off. And then, of course, we got this amazing news about Sacha Baron Cohen's new film and the scene in it where Rudy Giuliani...
Oh, spoiler alert!
Spoiler alert is, I mean, it's all over now, isn't it? It's over everywhere. But in Sacha Baron Cohen's follow-up to Borat, which is out now, Rudy Giuliani's seen reaching into his trousers while reclining on the bed in the presence of the actor playing Borat's daughter, who is posing as a TV journalist for a fake news conservative news program. Giuliani drinks scotch with her, coughs, fails to socially distance, agrees to eat a bat with his interviewer, and then goes back to her bedroom, the bedroom of a hotel suite, which is rigged with concealed cameras. Giuliani can be seen lying back on the bed, fiddling with his untucked shirt and reaching into his trousers. There you go. And he said that he was simply tucking his trousers in, to which Donald Trump said, he tweeted, I've tucked my trousers in on many occasions. Which
best trouser tucker of all time.
No one tucks in a trouser like me. And I think it's...
Are you a tucker in
there? I too have tucked my trousers in. I don't think there's anyone who's not tucked their trousers in. Whether they have chosen to do it while in the presence of a sort of rented hotel room with an attractive...
Have you ever had an embarrassing tucking in moment?
I can't imagine. I've not been interrupted by Sacha Baron Cohen while tucking in my trousers. I would say that would be the sort of the acid test.
Is it because I is untucked?
So it's weird, isn't it? So we don't know what Trump did. I mean, I am guessing that he started an answer, interrupted himself, then he said, let me finish. Then he interrupted himself again, and then he got cut off by the moderator for agreeing with himself.
I loved him dancing.
I think he'll probably do his dancing again.
Well, do you know what? There is political precedent for this, isn't there? Because you remember, of course, Theresa May's best moment as Prime Minister was when she danced.
I predicted that she would dance at the conference.
You did.
She did dance at the conference.
So I was there in the hall and she came out dancing, and I remember very clearly picking up my phone and sending you a message going, oh my God, you were right.
I was watching.
That was brilliant. I'm doing the dance right now. I think we can all remember.
Amazing.
What the glorious days of Theresa May's premiership.
Oh no. Golden, halcyon days, weren't they? I mean,
everything was so much simpler.
It was a simpler time. I think if Joe Biden took a leaf out of Angela Rayner's book and called Donald Trump scum, it would probably be the nicest thing that anyone said about anyone in the whole debate. But, you know, maybe something else has happened. I will be talking about the American elections. I think next week's podcast will be an American election fest. Liz Gerrard. I've gone American. Liz is about to join.
Howdy. Howdy, Liz.
And here she is. And we could talk to... We could talk to Liz, which is fantastic.
Liz, are you there?
I'm here, yes, hi.
Fantastic. Well, lovely to chat to you, Liz, as always. I think the last time we had you on the podcast, was it for the live 200th edition one? I think it might have been, might it? Liz Gerrard, for anyone who doesn't know, is the New Europeans, resident media expert, I think, former night editor at the Sunday Times, amongst other incredible jobs across Fleet Street. She is the First Lady of Fleet Street, and she's here to talk to us about the Daily Star. You've written a piece, I think, for this week's New European. But Liz, why don't you just tell us a little bit about where the Daily Star was and exactly what transformation has happened in the last sort of 12 months or so?
The Daily Star has been quite predictable. It functions on reality TV. So I'm a celebrity. There's a whole sequence of things you see, right? There's always going to be a fix at the end of these things. The weather, we're always going to have killer storms because you can bet your life that a tree will fall down and kill at least someone. So it becomes a killer storm anytime it becomes windy. You have lots of mutant rats. And giant mosquitoes and all sorts of terrible things that are coming in from abroad to kill us. It's a very larky paper. It's sort of up from the Sunday Sport, but it's always been a big fun paper. Psycho seagulls are an annual thing that come. Last summer, I think one psycho seagull kept a couple hostage in their home for 6 days because they couldn't get out because they were being bombarded by these things that were attacking them. There's an endless supply of these stories. And then suddenly it's got a bit political. And it's working. And somewhere along the line, they've got someone with some genius ideas for front pages, rather, as we have Chris Barker.
Right.
And they are coming up with some starry ones. The first one this year was jokey rather than political, and that was on February the 1st, when, of course, great day of independence, it might have been the 31st of January, not sure which, great day of independence, all of the Brexit press was celebrating that we were now out of the EU, and the Daily Star also had a front page celebrating being out of the EU, or celebrating a historic day. And the historic day, hang on, I'm just calling it up on my screen.
So yes, I have to say, when I saw, without giving it away before you do, when I saw this front page, I was shocked. I mean, for any, and I adore Psycho Pigeons and Killer Rats and all that kind of thing. I really love the tabloid press for all its, you know, I understand that it can be nasty, et cetera, for all its dark side. But as a tabloid watcher, I was just like, wow, this is quite something. So tell us about that front, Liz.
Well, this one I'm talking, I think you're probably thinking about Dominic Cummings, are you?
No, I'm thinking about the Brexit Day one. Yeah.
No, that's right. Souvenir edition, nice Union flag at the top. Today is a truly historic moment for our great nation. That's right, it's the end of dry January.
It's brilliant. That's brilliant.
Very good.
It is brilliant.
It was just going off at a tangent. But then it did get political, and let me have a look through.
And when we get the other thing is probably worth mentioning, Liz, as you flick. So I know you've got this incredible library of newspapers in front of you that you're flicking through there. But the other thing is probably worth mentioning is, of course, the Daily Star has had a change of ownership, which I guess might have something to do with this a little bit. Would you say?
I think it's got something to do with it to the extent that it's got a new editor.
Yeah.
But it's not moved that far away from where it always was. And it's now owned by Reach, which owns It and the Express, used to be Desmond's, now they're owned by the same people as the Mirror. Mm-hmm. The Express, when the takeover happened, the first thing that happened to the Express, Gary Jones came in and the migrant hating front pages stopped. Like that, ping, all came down, and that was the end of that. But in every other respect, the paper has stayed the same in that it still is telling old people how to live forever. It doesn't have quite so many miracle cures, drink coffee and beetroot to save your life, that sort of stuff. But it's still as rabidly anti-EU as it ever was.
There's a bit less about Princess Diana. I've not seen her on the front for a while.
She's been dead for a few years.
Every single Monday, they used to splash on Princess Diana. Every single Monday for about 5 years.
They used to stop them before.
Not so many murders and things. But of course, they're both still, they were both, until the latest development, still constantly picking up on Madeleine McCann.
Yes.
That, as indeed does the Mirror. The Mirror's obsessed with old crimes. But so the Star also hasn't changed its spots at all. It's not gone left. I mean, I'm looking at a headline here now, "You Horrible Little Snowflakes." It's free to go on the rampage with the bridge killer. There is a lot of still, we're not woke, we're not lefties, we're still on the right of the spectrum, but they've lost patience with the government, and they've lost patience so spectacularly in a way that the other papers are just busy saying to, everything that Johnson says just gets reported straight. Whereas the Star has taken upon itself actually to start questioning what's going on and doing it very effectively indeed.
And of course, the famous one has been these cut out masks, which I mentioned before you came on, and I hope some of our listeners are wearing them.
I look, the New European indeed did a cut out mask for last Halloween.
We've done them a few times actually for Halloween. Yeah, so maybe they are getting some of their ideas from the New European. Very different products, of course. But what do you think? How effective can good there is an element of satire here, of course, but how effective can sort of biting sort of political satire like this in our tabloid newspapers? And of course, The Star isn't the first to do this. I think it's very reminiscent of, Kelvin McKenzie divides opinion, but his son, when they did it, when they were really biting and really having a go at government, they did it superbly well. How effective is it, do you think?
I think it's very effective. And I think it's very effective when it comes from somebody like the Daily Star, because it's suddenly getting a profile that it's not had before. When it features almost daily on the 6:10 front page news round. It was on there today with its tracksuit bottoms. Yesterday it had another set of clowns on the front page. It's getting mentioned on the Radio 4 Today programme news review, which is in the past, it's just been there to be laughed at, really. Mm. And they're getting their message across. And it's what's not only are they saying things that other papers aren't saying, they're actually showing up the Sun even more for being so completely beholden to this government. And so the contrast is stark.
Well, that's really interesting, because I have a love-hate relationship with the Sun. I think we can all understand where the sort of hate comes from. But I think in the past it has been a very important and also excellently written newspaper. But do you think it's tired now? Do you think it's boring? Do you think it needs a shake-up?
Shall I read you? I had an email the other day from an old friend of mine who used to be a very senior member of the Sun. He may even have been their deputy editor at one point. I'm not sure. I won't go so far as that. But, and it, let me see if I can find it for you.
Because, of course, we've talked about this quite a lot on this podcast in recent times, because we had a chap who'd written a book about the
written Sunburn, which seems to be selling quite well.
Excellent, yeah. Which was and it is fascinating to look. I know I'm fascinated as to how Murdoch created the Sun and where it came from and everything, but I do feel like it just feels a bit obvious at the moment. And I never used to feel that from the Sun, even if I disagreed with it, which I often did, of course. But it just feels a bit like it just exists now.
Right, so this is from former Sun man. It says, the problem with Sun is it's now run by people who think they know what readers want. In the past, it was run by people who knew what the readers want. Mm-hmm. The new humanist Sun leadership have never visited the dog and duck themselves, but have this quaint idea that all readers live there, watching Spurs, throwing darts and eating pork scratchings. The Mirror made the same mistake in the 80s, thinking all its punters were Andy Capps with Whippet and a racing pigeon. Kelvin's genius was that he knew when it was time for beer and Skittles and when it was time to get serious. Today's Sun is so far up Morris's backside on that it's become an embarrassment.
Well, I think that says it all, because, and it's difficult sometimes for people to quite understand this, because there's almost nothing that I agree with Kelvin McKenzie on. But I still would put him up there with some of my journalistic heroes, because he knew his reader so well. And because, he got so many things wrong, and he quite rightly is called out for those things. But, I mean, one of my favourite periods in tabloid history was that period after Thatcher, when Major, and of course Murdoch backed Major, I believe, I think, yes, he did. And then just the wheels fell off, didn't they, spectacularly, after the 1992 election and the ERM and all that kind of thing, when we had to leave the exchange rate mechanism. And Kelvin, and I think Murdoch definitely agreed with him, just went, let's just go after Major now. And I feel like it was shocking, because this was a Tory paper that was of that side of politics attacking one of their own. And I guess that's why the current stuff from the story is reminiscent of that, I guess.
I think what's so important is that if you, and the Mail, much as I have many issues with the Mail, is doing the same thing. You go after your friends and tell them where they're going wrong. You don't just parrot out what they're doing. It's not being a true friend. If you are a believer in the Conservative cause, then you've got to tell them when they're getting it wrong as much as pander to them when they're getting it right, in your opinion. And if you just pretend that everything's hunky-dory and everything's all right, and you think that three Thursdays in succession, that it's acceptable just to put up a front page that says, go out tonight and clap for the NHS, which is what they did. They devoted their entire front page on three successive Thursdays just to telling people to stand on their doorsteps and clap. That's not news. That's not being a newspaper. That's not telling your readers anything. They've just got this obsession with telling people what to do.
I wonder whether they are... I wonder whether the Sun and the Mail are wary of... being critical of the government during a pandemic, and I wonder whether that's got something to do with it. And I've got to say, I was quite surprised to look at the front pages on Thursday morning and see that we can talk about Angela Rayner a little bit later, but the votes last night or Wednesday night rather. About free school meals was a fairly big story, and I don't think that's made any front page today, apart from the Daily Mirrors, which had quite a striking front page with the names of all of the 323 Tories, or however many it was, who voted against giving free school meals to children during the holidays. That seems to me to be the sort of thing that, you know, the Paul Dacre Mail might have seized on, and even the Kelvin McKenzie Sun might have seized on and said, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, the Mirror did the others didn't. And of course, the Sun, of course, it again reinforcing this self-obsession, you know, right, back the poppy appeal, you know, sort of. I'm a poppy star, are you? You know, sort of, what is that? The Mail has not exactly been generous to the government over this pandemic. It's been pretty much on its case, I think, more so than you might have expected.
Yeah, I agree.
The Express, I see a back on Brexit.
Do you think... Liz, if you've got 2 minutes, I love chatting to you because I'm a newspaper obsessive and so are you, and I know Stevie's too, but it's great when we've got you on. So while we've got you on, and we've spoke about the Mail before, and we spoke about it when we did the live webinar, but I have Geordie is my former editor at this, when I worked at the Standard, he was my editor, and I've got a lot of time for him actually. How do you think he's doing at the Mail? And I know I asked you that before, and I think we're sort of 3-4 months on now. Do you think the Mail have got it right? And do you think, or do you think they've moved away from their reader a little bit? Do you think Dacre had it right with regards to the pandemic and the response?
I think they're definitely right on the pandemic. In fact, they could be harder, but given that they are, I think Geordie Gray is still being quite, you know, he's treading a tightrope, isn't he? He doesn't want to upset the Paul Dacre following public.
But you see, Matt Kelly, our publisher and former editor and founder, along with Steve of the New European, wrote a great piece for GQ about Geordie and spoke to him, and it was all about this, you know, we don't want the brand to be toxic anymore. Do you think he's managing that? Do you think he still has a long way to go?
I still think he's got a long way to go, but he is trying. He's trying. But he's, I mean, if you look at today's front page, it's still the same old thing. Jenny Murray, why I'm going topless on TV. Gilly Cooper, it's so hard for men to flirt now. So poor old men, you know. So I'm now, of course, if Dacre was still in charge, Now, I'm saying this, but for all I know, they might very well have done it. I've been busy doing other things this week. But if Dacre had been in charge, there'd be a much more of a fuss about the prostate cancer and fallout from COVID than there has been, I think, in the Mail.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember a front page that was about how men were suffering from discrimination and that they were being put upon because their cancers weren't getting as much attention as breast cancer. It was a totally unnecessary creation of gender politics.
I think that was where, you know, full disclosure, and this is no secret to any of the listeners to this podcast, I also work for the Daily Mail. And, you know, I think, you know, Dacre just lost his touch in the last few years, didn't he? And he certainly did have it for his readership. Disagree with him or not, you know, that's not the issue. He knew who his reader was. And I think much like we're talking about the Sun now, he just went a bit, I don't want to use any sort of wrong terms, but he just lost it with, he just went too far. And that toxicity, which Geordie is trying to sort out now, was created by Dacre. I mean, he probably should have waved goodbye before any referendums happened, let's say.
if only we'd been in a different place then.
I'm also interested in Liz, and again, while we've got you, and sorry, Steve, I know I'm absolutely hogging the chat with Liz, but I find her absolutely fascinating to chat to. The Mirror interests me as well. Where do you see, because, you know, one of our great tabloid mastheads, of course, along with the Sun and perhaps the Daily Star in time, if it carries on in the way it's going. But where is it now? And, you know, what do you think it needs to do to get back to something like the glory days of, you know, I loved Piers Morgan's editorship of the Mirror, for example.
I think the Mirror has been lost for,
since Piers left, perhaps.
Well, for a long time. It seems to, as I said, it's got this obsession with old crimes, and it really is sort of, I mean, Jill Dando, Madeleine McCann, but you go further back than that, and you know, the Bamba crimes and the M25 man whose name escapes me. It is constantly pumping up these. I remember it did a front page. I mean, this must be God knows how many years ago now, 3-4 years ago, I don't know. But it had a picture of Harry Roberts, who, as you may know or may not know, killed 3 policemen back in our part of the world in the 60s. And yeah. he went off and he hid in Thorley Woods near where my sister lived. So I remember the era quite clearly. So it's a long, long, long time ago, very old story. He duly went to prison and I think he was released on license very recently. So he must have served 30, 40 years in jail. Nasty man, yes. But the Mirror had a front page on him getting a driving license as if this was, you know, sort of an absolute national scandal, that somebody who had supposedly paid their debt to society should actually be allowed to have a driving license. And it's this obsession with old things. And the Mirror, I can't forgive for the referendum, even more than I can't forgive Dacre, because the Mirror just didn't turn up. So you had the Mail, the Express, the Sun, the Telegraph absolutely hammering the Brexit case day in, day out. And the Mirror just would occasionally put it on page 2. I remember one very bad, or in my opinion, very bad splash headline, which was about Osborne's budget and how it was a punishing budget for, this was Osborne saying what would happen if we had Brexit. And it was as though we are anti-Tory and we can't work out that we're actually on the same side as the Tories here. And this was the Remain case. And it was, if you looked at it, you would think, oh, yes, this is yet another nasty Tory budget. And they couldn't cope with being on the same side as a Tory government. They were all over the place with Corbyn. They didn't know what to do with themselves. Yeah. I mean, the Guardian was a bit lost as well. So they just haven't really turned up when it's mattered. And that's what's given, I think, you know, the left people always mock the Guardian, and the readerships of these places are tiny now.
The world's worst, of course, as Kelvin used to call it, Liz.
but the Mirror could have, you know, sort of the on the referendum, the Sun delivered its brickies and the Mail delivered its middle class people and the Express delivered their old people vote, and they all got their constituencies out to vote. But where were all the nurses and the carers and the people that you would expect to vote to read the Mirror? Where were they? They didn't get them on board with the referendum. They didn't engage them, and they did nothing to point out what Europe did. You know, they should have been going to Ebervale and saying, look, this is what happens. Yeah. This is what Europe does for you. And they didn't. They just didn't turn up. They thought, oh, this is too boring for readers. We won't sell any papers by banging on about Europe. We'd do much better by talking about Jill Dando or Madeleine.
And well, I think they probably thought that a great many of their readers, I think that, you know, I worked at the Mirror, as you know, for a lot of years, and people at the Mirror were always terrified of putting the readers off, scaring off more readers, and whether that was changing the TV page or coming out for something that was unpopular or, you know, slagging off Liverpool FC or Manchester United. There was always a great fear went round the newsroom. It didn't so much in Piers's day, but certainly with the people who follow Piers. I've got an awful lot of admiration and for people who were there then and the people who are still running it now. I've got an awful lot of admiration and time for. But I do think that you're absolutely right, Liz. The Mirror failed to really take a side and really hammer it home. The front page on the day, Don't Take a Leap into the Dark with a picture of a black hole or something, was just unbelievably poor.
And that, of course, was a complete mystery to people because they hadn't been, you know, they hadn't been reporting on it. And suddenly, oh, here we are on the day. Oh, we've got an opinion.
And it did, and it followed on. It was amazing to me that it followed on to, you know, it was 2 years after the Daily Record failed to take a side on which way people should vote in the Scottish independence referendum. I do think that, you know, there's papers have got attitudes, haven't they? And on those occasions, they failed to have an attitude, which I thought was a mistake in both cases, despite it really admiring and liking a lot of the people involved.
Do you know what? And Liz, go on.
Just all that said, I've got this month's Daily Mirrors up on my screen, and they're good. You know, I mean, they are good, and they are better than the Star, but the Star is noticeable because it's come out with these occasional ones here. But they are good. You know, Northern Fury, one lockdown rule for them, are particularly good. You know, they take Stanley Johnson to task. But there's one, Every Parent's Nightmare, and this was the thing that really got me, was these kids at university in Newcastle. Three kids died, and nobody touched it. And you think, what's going on with the world? But the Mirror did. Windbag on the Widden Farm rubbish. And again, you know, they're going for their Manchester readership.
I love the Mirror. You know, Hugh Cudlip is right up there, way beyond Kelvin McKenzie in my journalistic heroes. And I do hope, you know, I think they've got a brilliant political editor now, a friend of mine, Pippa Crayer, who I worked with at Standard.
She is fantastic. She's absolutely fabulous.
Absolutely brilliant. She was the City Hall editor when I was on the desk at the Standard, and she is fantastic. And And I think, you know, with her in charge of the politics, I think they've got a really bright future ahead of them. But I absolutely agree that they need to, they just need some attitude. And I don't think actually they're helped out by the likes of the Star and the Mail having a go at the government, because you'd expect the Mirror to have a go at the Tory government.
Well, that's exactly right. That's why when I was doing my thing this week, I was looking at the Sun against the Star, because as you say, there's no point saying, look, yes, the other people are doing this. Will you expect the Mirror to do it? It's their job to do it.
Can I ask you a couple of things before we let you go, Liz? The first one is, let me ask you a couple of things and then you can answer them. The first one is, we talked about the Star. I find the Star's front page is very amusing. Jonathan Clark, who's the editor, I always liked when I was at the Mirror and is a great operator. We all talk about the Star's front pages. We all think they're great. They get mentioned on the TV and the radio, as you say. Do you think that has any sort of cut through at all with the Star's core readers? Because the Star's readership doesn't seem to be coming, seem to be going up, or it doesn't seem to be, the decline doesn't seem to be slowing down. So is this just something that's nice for us and the Star's readers don't really care about it? And the other thing is, we talked about 1992 and Black Wednesday. We talked about when the Sun and the Mail sort of started to nice up to Tony Blair. There's no real sign of the Sun and the Mail and other newspapers being interested in Keir Starmer at all, is there? Why do you think that is? And do you think that will change?
No, I don't think they're interested in Keir Starmer. They want a Conservative government. They want a different Prime Minister. They don't want a different government. They're not going to back Starmer. They're going to go for Rishi, I think. I think Murdoch's already sort of switching horses. I think Gove's horse has bolted. Well, I hope so. And so I think that's where they're looking. I don't think that's going to be the country's rescue package.
Yeah.
But I think that's the way they'll go. They won't back Starmer. Last time we spoke, we talked about the Mail on Sunday's laughable attempt to blame Keir Starmer for as being a hypocrite.
Donkey gate.
Field. But you know, I don't think they're ever going to say that Labour is better unless something goes really wrong. If Johnson goes in within the next year, which I'm sure he will, and they get Sunak in, assuming they get somebody in from somebody more sensible in, I think they'll stick with them. Something would have to go very wrong for them to want to switch towards Labour.
And on the Star thing, is there any cut through, or is it just
I don't know. Their circulation, of course, everybody's took a terrible dive with, they're all down 20% on last year, courtesy of COVID. So they're all really suffering. The Star has gone up by 2% month on month when others have gone up 1%. Whether that's because of Dom cutouts, I don't know. But I think the thing that I put in that piece today was that I like the fact that they respect their readers enough to assume that they know who Dominic Cummings is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that other tabloids would assume that they wouldn't.
But John Clark there has taken a leaf right out of Kelvin's book, hasn't he? You know, it was him that famously did the now we've all been screwed by the cabinet, all the Lamont stuff, you know, the white van man of the Sun readership of those days. It was assumed that he liked the footy and a pint, but he also knew he was in the cabinet.
But the other thing that was really important, I mean, with this piece last week that the Sun did, that the Star did, about Cummings and his council tax, is that the story was broken by the Northern Echo. It's made television, it's made radio, it's made social media. The Guardian did a story on it. The Telegraph did a two or three pars. The Mirror did two or three pars. none of the others even reported it in print, whether they put it on their websites, I don't know. I mean, can you imagine that? Sort of 6 out of 10 national newspapers didn't report that the Downing Street Chief of Staff, or whatever his title is, his formal title is, you know, sort of has had a £30,000 debt just sort of written off, and nobody even thinks it's worth a sentence.
Yeah, it was very odd. And
I mean, that is extraordinary.
Yeah. And a wonderful piece of
for the star splashing on it.
Yeah. Wonderful piece of regional newspaper journalism as well by the remember the chap's name at the Northern Echo, but that was great piece of dogged.
Because they didn't just sort of stop at the point when everybody else could have when everybody else stopped, you know, all right, Barnard Castle, I cite all those jokes and everything, but they actually started digging, and then to unearth the fact that these things weren't even built with proper planning permission, and then this thing, but now of course I think they're going after them, aren't they?
Listen, Liz, we should probably just do our own media chat podcast, because I could literally sit here and talk to you all afternoon.
I'm sorry, I've sort of taken up too much of your time.
Not at all. We've taken up too much of your time. It's been absolutely fascinating to chat to you.
Next time we should talk about the crazy anti-maskers and anti-vaxxers at the Telegraph. But thanks, Liz. It's great to talk to you.
We'd really love to have you on again soon, Liz, and because I think your insight on this is absolutely superb. So thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for your time.
I'll tell you what else I like, Steve, on the Star, because you know in modern times we have to think we're old inky hacks, and yes. as is Liz, and Liz won't mind me saying that, but they're launching this brilliant thing on their website where they do a Russian roulette sort of new. So you press this button and you just get whatever story it gives you, a sort of roulette thing.
Oh, right, okay,
it's a great idea.
That is. I remember us talking about that. Many years ago when I was.
Well, if only you'd actioned it.
There are no new ideas in this world. I think that was one of Malcolm Coles's ideas.
You go, good old Malcolm. Well, you know, talent borrows, Steve, and genius steals. We spoke to Liz for far too long. That's all my fault, because I really do find her fascinating. But
it was fascinating, you know. And I know not all our listeners will be as obsessed with newspapers as you are and as I am. But I hope you got a great deal out of that. No one really talks about them as well as Liz Gerrard, I don't think.
No, I don't think so. let's talk about Andy Burnham.
Well, should we just talk about... I mentioned Angela Rayner, and I just wanted to
talk yes.
about that. Now, obviously, what Angela Rayner said about Chris Clarkson, you could hear her saying scum as Chris Clarkson, who's from Haywood and Middleton, which is not far from where I used to live in Manchester. You could hear her saying scum while he was talking about how Labour was opportunistic and guilty of hindsight when talking about Andy Burnham. She then appeared to deny it. I don't know what the sort of comeback will be for Angela Rayner. It took a lot of the gloss off, well, not the gloss, but it took a lot of the of sort of noise away from what was should have been a really strong day for Labour, I thought.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was, you know, it gave ammo to the Conservatives, and it was really stupid. But I think beyond that, it's, you know, listen, I know that every week I have a go at the Brexiteers of the week and stuff like that. And there are two or three people, there are more than two or three people that I seriously dislike among them. And I think that some people are genuinely racist. And I think that some people genuinely are opportunists. But a great number of people that I disagree with are just people that I disagree with. I don't think that they are scum. And I think that we've got to get away from this sort of idea that, you know, there's a great on the left. There is a great you know, assumption of holiness, and that anyone who disagrees with us is not holy in some way, and is verging on evil. And I just thought that was really crystallized by, you know, somebody scoring a few anodyne political points and being called scum. I've got a lot of time for Angela Rayner. I think she's great. But I just thought on that occasion she made a mistake, and it was a mistake that was indicative of a lot of people.
Do you know what it felt to me like?
I see she's getting an awful lot of people agreeing with her, and Tory hashtag Tory scum trending.
No, listen, do you know what? I it felt like Corbyn's Labour again.
Yeah, I will.
Do you know what? These should be serious people. Now the word scum is not a nice word, and I grew up in West Yorkshire where there is a lot of hatred between a lot of different people when I was a boy, at least. But the word scum always makes me think of the rivalry between Leeds United and
Manchester United. Yeah.
Manchester United mainly, certainly during that period.
Yeah.
And I just think, well, you know, it just feels like we're really arguing about football. I love football. You love football. Everyone hates Leeds. I'm just kidding. But, you know, and Angela Rayner should be above using that word. I'm sorry, but she just should. It's not a nice word. It just makes her look stupid. Listen, I'm not saying I agree with, I agree with her in the sense that she's annoyed, with the comments but it is unparliamentary, and I know that sounds ridiculous, but this isn't a fight in a pub. This is democracy. And actually, she's better than that, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
That's absolutely right. You know, when you see, let's go through a couple of them. Brendan Clark-Smith, he's a Tory MP. I can't remember where he's from. I don't believe in nationalising children. We need to get back to the idea of taking responsibility. This means less celebrity virtue signalling on Twitter. Which is talking, you know, directly to Marcus Rashford. Rashford, by the way, they are going to cave in on this, like they cave in on everything else. They've already given Marcus Rashford an MBE. He's going to end up with a knighthood.
I thought you made a very good point when we were talking to Liz, because
he's going to be Baron Rashford.
Baron Rashford.
Marcus of Rashford.
I thought you made a very good point when we were talking to Liz. The Mail, or indeed the Sun, should absolutely massively get behind Marcus Rashford, because is a campaign that is very winnable, and it will be U-turned, and that they will win. And then they can go, oh, look what we did. And Marcus can say, thanks to the Sun, thanks to the Mail, thanks to the Daily Star, perhaps, John, if you're listening.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because you're right, they are going to cave in on it, because they've caved in on it before. And Marcus Rashford is the best politician we've got in the country at the moment.
Yeah. This sort of notion of, as you say, you can see why Angela Rayner is annoyed when you hear people like Ben Bradley saying it's not as simple as you make out, Marcus, like to make out, Marcus. It passes responsibility from feeding kids away from parents to the state and increases dependency. Some parents are not good parents and prioritise things ahead of their kids. It's a small minority, but some do step out of the PC bubble and come and live in the real world. You know, this is
what I'll say about that. Isn't that was a,
Ben Bradley,
that
was a, who is tipped as a future Tory leader, saying we're not going to give free meals to kids who need free meals because a small minority of people will spend some of their money on something other than their children. I mean, it's absolutely disgraceful. But it doesn't, you know.
What I'd say is, actually, Ben Bradley, clearly an idiot, and he'll never be the leader of the Conservative Party, or indeed the Prime Minister. But he's not wrong in some respects. But just putting blame on bad parents is not good enough. What we need to do is educate and help these parents and help these children that are in dire need now. You know, it's almost like those, and I once saw this, and it was one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen, someone walking past a homeless person and saying, get a job. You know what I mean? It's that kind of
exactly. It's
stupidity. That. We have to help them, get up and get a job. You know, that's what the state is for. I'm no fan of big state, but we have to help them to go down the right path. So just saying, nah, you starve, that'll teach you all bad parents a lesson, is despicable and disgusting.
Yeah, it is. And the amount and the number of, you know, the small minority that he talks about is a tiny minority, which you know, people on the right always try and imply is huge, and the, you know, the sort of the war on the so-called scroungers and stuff like this. We've lived through all of this kind of stuff, and you know, I understand why she is vexed, but I just don't think she did us any credit there. Maybe, you know, I would have respected her more if she'd said I was just shouting out names of Ray Winston films that I like. I didn't really mean to call him scum. And then she'd said, and when if Boris Johnson stood up, she'd have gone, ooh, sexy beast, and stuff like that. So, I mean, she could have got out of it.
Oh, God, that would be dangerous. Angela, don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that, Angela. Who said this, by the way? If the government can subsidise eat out to help out, not being seen to give poor kids lunch in the school holidays looks mean and is wrong. Do you know who said that?
I don't, but it's a good point.
Subsidise, eat out to help out, not being seen to give poor kids lunch in school holidays looks mean and is wrong.
Well, it's true. I mean, me and you, very achingly middle class.
Yeah.
But perhaps from, you know, well, working class backgrounds, enjoyed eat out to help out. I went out 8 nights a week during eat out to help out. I don't know who said it. Tell me.
That was said by Nigel Farage even a stop clock gives the right time twice a day.
Wow.
I would say
we agree.
When it's a strange world when you're agreeing with Nigel Farage, but on that occasion he's absolutely right, and that is why, going back to what we were saying before, the Mail and the Sun should be all over this.
Yeah. Know? Yeah.
Marcus Rashford, one of the most popular people in the country, isn't he?
It's just, it's winnable. It's winnable. And do you know, hey, do you know who really fancies Marcus Rashford?
Go on.
Well, do you guess?
Is it Mrs. Rashford? I don't know. Is it Angela Rayner? I don't know.
Colonel Kurtz.
Oh, Colonel Kurtz. Yeah, paramour. There you
okay,
go.
What we got? What else we got in the news? Because we're vastly running out of time.
Well, we want to talk about the King of the North, don't we? We want to talk about Andy Burnham. My first question about Andy Burnham is not has he kidnapped Paul Heaton and just stolen Paul Heaton out of the beautiful South's glasses and his lovely anorak and all of that kind of stuff. But my question to you is, Andy Burnham has riled up the government, hasn't he? We've seen that they are riled with him. He's got a very fractious relationship with Robert Jenrick. We now see that the government are trying to cut him out of stuff altogether, giving money directly to local mayors in Greater Manchester rather than the mayor of Greater Manchester. Is he playing a blinder here, or has he overplayed his hand somewhat? And does this sort of, is this all feeding into, you know, is this part of a government strategy to sort of claw back some power from the regional mayors?
I don't think that's the case, but I'll get to that in a second. I think it was brilliant, as a northerner, it was brilliant to see Andy Burnham stand up to government. And I often bang on about how the east of England doesn't have a proper representative in those high level chats with government like the other regions that are devolved. And I see, you know, I tell MPs, business leaders, etc., how important that is. And it was all going really well for me because Andy Burnham was doing it, and I am a fan of Andy Burnham. He's a nice chap as well. I've met him on a couple of occasions, and I think he would have been a very good Labour leader, and he still might be, but I think he tripped this week. I think this was basically an argument over £5 million, wasn't it, in the end? And I mean, it was a bit of theatre, wasn't it? His press conference and getting shown it and all that kind of thing. We know that. I think that's accepted now. That was a bit of theatre. that was silly, really. It was just silly. And I think probably his ego just won him over a little bit there. I still think he's a great politician. The Hillsborough stuff was fantastic, of course, and that sort of got him where he is now, I think. And I still think he's got a lot to give Greater Manchester, obviously, but the country at large. And I think we'll probably see him back in full national politics before too long. But he did, you know, when he walked out in his big coat, and a lot of people saying, "Oh, now's not the time for an Oasis reunion." Did feel a bit like that. It felt like he was believing his own hype a little bit, and it opened the door for Boris to do what one of my team described as a mic drop when he went, "Well, we're going to give you the money anyway."
Well, I mean,
but he managed to take the high road there, and
he did. I mean, let's give Andy Burnham some credit, and let's not credit Boris Johnson with something. If he was going to do that anyway, and he'd intended to do it anyway, he would have said that he was going to do that in his press conference on.
I agree completely. Tuesday. I agree completely. But But Andy walked
into
that
to
trap.
It was a bit late, wasn't it? If he'd said immediately, "Well, we're going to give you the money anyway, but you're just not going to get your little mitts on it," then it would be fine. But the fact that it took him until PMQs the next day.
Steve, I agree completely, but I'm just talking about politics. And I think that when, that is the right thing to do from government. And I think Andy Burnham was doing the right thing to try and get the best deal for his people. That's what politics is about. But he walked into that trap, even if it wasn't laid at the time and someone came up with the idea afterwards. It was a bit of a cock up on his part, I feel.
Well, yeah, I mean, they were always going to do that, weren't they? So in effect, he was kind of playing with house money, wasn't he? And I don't know whether it sort of makes people think worse of him. Do you think that he sees himself as a future Labour leader? Because, you know, there's a lot of Ian Martin wrote a piece in the Times, I think it was towards the end of last week. It might have been last Saturday. Quite controversial. He quoted a senior figure from the Blair era saying Andy Burnham is the real deal. He also quoted a former ministerial colleague of Andy Burnham's saying Andy is one of the most unprincipled politicians I've ever met. His speech on the supposed attack on the North was disgraceful, populist rubbish. I don't know. I think there was also somebody from the Brown administration who was sort of calling him a bit of an opportunist as well. Do you think that he sees something bigger than being the mayor of Greater Manchester?
Maybe. I've got to say that I don't. I think Andy Burnham's a good guy, and I think he would. Having him in a Labour cabinet or a shadow cabinet would make it better. I think he's good. Whether he's a future leader of the Labour Party, I'm not entirely sure. I think Keir's got that stitched up for a while, to be honest, and we all know how much I love Keir Starmer. I think Andy Burnham's time as a potential leader perhaps has gone, but he's not an old man, you know. He's a young chap. He's certainly got a chance to hold high office, I would suggest. And I like him. So, yeah, I think he's good now. And do you know what? People like him. And that's gold dust for politicians. And beyond, you know, I said that I think he's misstepped once or twice this week. But what he's good at is rallying folk. And people like someone who will fight for them. And I'm not from Manchester. I'm from nearby. You are from Manchester. And it was just great to hear someone fighting for their part of the country, for saying, you know, we want more, we deserve more, and this is why, and standing up to the government.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. He was right to have a go.
Yeah.
He kept down from 90 to 75 to 65. It's a shame that the government decided that they wanted to make an example of him. Manchester will stay heavily red, I would imagine.
And do you know what? Manchester is an
Hayward and Middleton, who was called an unpleasant name by by
Angela Rayner.
Will have a much shorter career than Andy Burnham will have.
Absolutely. And do you know what? There is still a feeling, and it does become tiresome when you're from the North, but there is still a feeling in the North that they've been hard done by for a long, long time. And the government were making a big deal about these red wall seats, all this kind of thing. And I think they've lost some of that as well now. It does seem to be old, like when Thatcher wanted to basically quarantine Liverpool and never mind, let's just put a fence around it and forget about it sort of thing.
Yes.
Like I say, Andy Burnham, I think he's made a couple of missteps, political missteps, but I think he's a good guy and I think he's a good politician. And I think Manchester is all the better for having him.
Well, I think people like politicians who wear their hearts on their sleeve and
wear their hearts on their Parker jackets,
even if it's the sleeve has got a Stone Island patch. So I think no one can doubt that he was speaking from the heart there. There was a little extra gravy.
Right, we're massively overrunning here, Steve. Massively, massively. So quickly, very quickly, I think you've got an Andy Burnham quiz. Let's do that, and then we've got to go to Matt Withers.
And then we're going to go to Matt Withers with Charlie Connolly. I've got a three-question quiz for you. Question one, are all the questions about Andy Burnham? Question one is, and I've lost the quiz here, but I think question one is, on which TV show did Andy Burnham's wife Frankie appear in 1992 while they were first dating?
Okay, complete guess. I've no idea, but I'm going to go for Remote Control.
Oh, it's not. Do you know what? It was actually appeared on Blind Date.
I think with Our Graham and Cilla.
With Cilla and Our Graham. It's just started going out with one another. She'd obviously already applied. She was paired with a bloke called Will Harris from Surrey, who turned out to be wearing a bright red T-shirt and faded denim dungarees. Their date didn't go that well, presumably because she was already going out with Andy Burnham. And Will Harris, bizarrely, went on to become a spin doctor for Michael Howard.
Wow. I mean, no wonder that relationship didn't go very well. That is extraordinary. Now, do you know where they went on their date? Because
they went to Gibraltar.
Because do you remember in the old days of Blind Date, you would get a crap date, like, oh, a meal in a beef eater. And then all of a sudden they were going abroad and stuff when the advertisers thought, oh, people are watching this. So they went to Gibraltar. So that's a pretty good date, isn't it?
You're going to New York, yeah. Yeah, and then some of them were going to the little chef. Question two then. In 2008, what did Andy Burnham deny ever having worn?
A merkin.
It's not a merkin, but it does begin with M. He said, I can say with my hand on my heart that I have never worn mascara.
Ah.
Because obviously he's got very sort of dark eyes, hasn't he?
Have you ever worn mascara, Steve?
I've never worn mascara. I've never worn guy liner. He said Andy Burnham said that even at school, people used to say you've got eyeliner on. He's a bit of a sad-eyed lady of the lowlands, isn't he, Andy Burnham? Hmm. Question three, then, and I know this is the exciting one for me. We'll try not to go on about this for too long. In 2017, Andy Burnham named his top five Manchester bands in order. Can you name Andy Burnham's top five Manchester bands?
Right, so I would like to thank Steve for giving me early sight of this question. and what I thought about with this was he's not going to want to alienate anyone because he's a politician.
Yeah.
So he's going to want a good spread. So he probably won't. I reckon Andy Burnham's record collection is pretty good, actually, but I reckon he's going to try and keep everyone happy.
Good.
So this is my 5-1. This is what I think Andy Burnham's favourite Manchester bands are. So at number five, Simply Red. Yeah. At number four, M People.
Yeah.
Number three, New Order. At number two, Stone Roses. And at number one, Oasis.
Well, you've only got two out of the five.
Oh, wow.
His choice in reverse order, number five, New Order. Number four, he picked the Verve, who are not from Manchester. They're from London. I mean, 25, 26 miles away. It's about as near to Liverpool as it is to Manchester Wigan.
Well, I did. I mean, I'm no surprise I got that wrong. I would, you know, I would have picked the Rolling Stones and the Beatles.
He picked the Cortinas. Who are at number three. Now they're from Middleton, aren't they? Mm. He picked the Smiths at number two, and he picked the Stone Roses at number one.
No Oasis in there. That's interesting.
No Oasis. Oh, are you gonna do your top five, Manchester?
Yes, Bears? I will. And do you know what? This has taken up most of my morning. I have to say.
It would, yeah.
And I'm really sad that I can't include the Buzzcocks, the Happy Mondays, New Order. That's really controversial. But this is what I've gone for. Okay. Number five, Oasis.
Yeah.
Number four, James. Number three, Stone Roses. Number two, Joy Division. Number one, Steve, can you guess?
You're going to say the Smiths, aren't you?
The Smiths. So go on, tell us yours then.
I've got number five. I've got A Certain Ratio.
Oh yes.
I've got that number four. I've got 808 State at number four.
Do you know what? 808 State were in my long list. Yeah, very good band.
State, as Gary Davis once called them. I've got Buzzcocks at number three.
Yeah.
I've got The Fall at number two, and I've got Joy Division at number one. I had a lot of angst about the positions of number one or two. Is it better to have two perfect albums and a few brilliant singles, or is it better to have, you know, well, two or three years of unparalleled brilliance and then a bit of a sort of patchy stuff later on over the career?
My reason for not putting, and you're a massive Fall fan, which I'm not, I like about 20 Fall songs, and that sounds like a lot if you compare them to Joy Division or whatever, but you've got to remember that the Fall have got about a million songs. The reason I left them out was exactly that. I think there's a lot of stuff that I can leave. I can leave alone. Anyway, there we go. We should probably hand over to Matt Withers and Charlie because we are very deep into this pod and we're going to get told off. So here's Matt Withers and Charlie Connolly.
From true crime to football, Brexit to folklore. For more great podcasts from Archant, head to audioboom.com/channel/Archant.
Hi, this week I'm joined by Charlie Connolly once again, who's written an article for this week's print edition on a new history of England, the ambitiously titled The Shortest History of England. Charlie, how are you doing?
Not too bad, Matt, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad. So tell us about the book. I suppose the obvious first questions are, who's it by and just how short is it?
It's by a writer called James Hawes, who has written a bunch of novels and came out in the kind of those sort of British novelists that came through in the mid-90s, like Irvine Welsh. But he's turned his attention to non-fiction in recent years, and he wrote a book called The Shortest History of Germany, which was very good a couple of years ago, and it was a bit of a bestseller. And he's now produced The Shortest History of England, and I can tell you how short it is because I've got the book here. And it is 270 pages, condensing the history of England into 270 pages, about 2,000 years worth of history. So quite the challenge, but he was up for it.
So you write in the article that Hawes doesn't buy into a narrative that England is, as you say a few times, the world's greatest nation ever, woo. So it's not a book for Michael Gove.
It's not a book for Michael Gove, no, although perhaps it should be. He might learn something. Because I think there's a kind of misconception that there's one narrative of English history, and it's a very patriotic one. And this kind of goes against that. And I know that Michael Gove and, you know, the whole Brexit narrative sort of buys into that narrative that we're the greatest country in the world. We gave the world free trade. We gave the world this. We gave the world that. They should all be jolly grateful. When, you know, the truth is a little bit more nuanced than that. There isn't one kind of, one monolith of the historical narrative that we can't deviate from And if we do deviate from that, we're not patriotic somehow. We don't love our country. Whereas James Hawes here presents a sort of different version of history. I mean, there is no definitive history of England, but he presents a history of England, which is a very persuasive one, that that we've got where we are today, despite the kind of the elites that are in charge and have been for centuries. And we've got where we are despite the kind of pronounced north-south divide, which I must admit, I was quite surprised to discover in the book that the north-south divide isn't a recent thing. I'd assumed it had come from the sort of Industrial Revolution time, but it goes way, way back to before the Norman Conquest. That there has been this divide roughly around where the River Trent is between the north and the south, to the extent that people in the north of England and the south of England spoke totally different languages right back then. But somehow the south seems to have triumphed in that perception of the country. And that this is something that Hawes explains very well in the book.
Yeah, once upon a time, we wouldn't have been able to conduct this interview because I'm very much from north of the Trent. It is a book of the history of England, not a book of the history of Britain. Does he explain why that he took that decision?
Not in so many words, but I mean, obviously with devolution, there is a strong kind of Scottish historical narrative and a Welsh historical narrative and, very, very complicated narrative in Ireland as well. I mean, I think there has always been a temptation, especially among the kind of the Michael Gove historians, to use England and Britain as synonyms, which is obviously is completely wrong, because now it is a separate country and we do have other separate countries in these islands. So it's taking England as the subject, and obviously England has come to dominate British history in many ways, but not exclusively. And it is an interesting angle to take, because he does point it makes it easier for him to point out the inequalities and division that have kind of really inhabited the historical narrative of England, and to a certain extent by extension Britain as well, because it's not a unified country. And that's something that comes across really well in the book. England has always been about division. It's always been about regions. It's always been, particularly since the Industrial Revolution, divided by class as well. And reading that whole narrative, I mean, history writing in recent years has become quite sort of focused on specific topics and specific people and specific periods and places, whereas the big sweeping narrative had gone out of fashion. But thankfully it's coming back in now, because when you see the strands of history that Hawes puts together in this book, and he takes the story right up to the prime ministership of Boris Johnson, and you can see the strands going right back through the centuries and right where we are today, how we got here, right back to the sort of the Enclosure Acts in the 15th and 16th century, the first Enclosure Acts, there were many after that, that sort of took the land away from the people and put us on that road to where we are now with this divided class society in England. And it's a book that made me cross. It's a book that made me feel like I'd missed out a lot. I did a degree in history, but I think certainly when I was at school, the history we learned was very selective. It was a very kind of, when I was at school, Northern Ireland, for example, was on the news every day, yet we never did Northern Ireland and the Troubles or anything like that, and the roots of the Troubles in our history classes at school. We did the causes of the First World War and the Six Wives of Henry VIII. It's because that the Northern Ireland situation came about for reasons that didn't fit in with that narrative. So I think the book does sort of set out to point out that the Gove-ish, if you like, version of English history that he was keen to promote when he was Secretary of State for Education, has been keen to promote since as part of the Brexit narrative, isn't the only narrative, and it isn't necessarily the right narrative for us to follow.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was at school many years ago, but history was basically Hitler, Stalin, and as much as we did English / British history, it was the Victorians, and not a great deal beyond that. I don't want to go for everything that's in the article, because people should very much go out and buy a copy of the paper, but a real standout moment, I did not know this, that Churchill wanted a referendum to decide whether the wartime national government should be extended, only for Clement Attlee to object to that. I mean, that is something I've never come across before.
No, me too. I mean, I always, you know, I grew up with that kind of narrative of history that we were taught. And when I found out that Churchill lost the election straight after the war, I was astounded. You know, I thought, Churchill, the man that got us through the war, that, you know, that gave us everything that we fought for, and he lost the election. And you realise it was a lot more complicated and nuanced than that. And Attlee was actually deputy prime minister during the war, the leader of the Labour Party at the time, through that kind of emergency government that was formed. And Churchill wanted to extend that beyond the war, and wanted a referendum. And Attlee, I haven't got it to hand, but there's a great quote, it's in the piece, about Attlee's attitude to referendums and their place in British society and British democracy, and is not really in favour of it, which, you know, has a clanging resonance for the reason we've got this podcast and this paper we both write for as well. There's a lot of history in there that I should have known. I kicked myself several times through this book of stuff thinking, why don't I know this? It does fill in a lot of gaps. It really does. And it's a very, very good, there's not a lot of nuance in the book because it is the shortest history of England. So it is quite sweeping, but there's plenty in there, plenty of detail of which I wasn't aware. And I'm really glad that I know about now.
Yeah, well, it sounds like an absolutely terrific read, as indeed is your article in this week's New European, which is on sale in all good shops now. Thanks a lot, Charlie.
Thanks, Matt.
Brexiteer of the Week.
Welcome back. That was fascinating. Matt Withers. Not only is Matt Withers our sort of roving reporter, chatting to some of the most interesting people that the New European employs as writers, etc., etc. He's also the man behind the scenes who makes this podcast arrive on your phone or other device. So thank you very much, Matt, for that. Steve, it's time for Brexiteers of the Week.
Charlie, Brexiteer of the Week. I'd like to mention a little-known politician called Nigel Farage, first of all.
Never heard of him.
We spoke last week about his new financial newsletter, Fortune and Freedom, with Nigel Farage. I've investigated this for my piece for the New European print edition this week. Please check it out. I particularly liked what happens is you get a newsletter from Nigel Farage every morning, and it's got a lot. I mean, he's not really a financial expert, is he, Nigel Farage, despite having been a commodities trader? So it tends to have a lot of the usual ranting from Nigel Farage about this, that, and the other, and then you get somebody talking about investments. This week, one of the ones this week said Nigel Farage was ranting on about spyware on our devices, facial recognition on the streets, cancel culture in social media, political correctness in the press, groupthink in the city, a dangerous reductive herd mentality sweeping through our entire culture. And you think, well, what's that got to do with investing some stocks and shares and stuff like that? And then one of his mates turns up, and this time it was a bloke called Rob Marstrand. And he said, it teed up a piece called How to Take Back Control of Your Finances in Four Simple Steps. And I thought, well, that sounds good. Four simple steps to take back control of my finances. And then I looked at them, and they were stuff that was familiar to all of us, Richard. You and I could do this. Mm. He said, you must first of all make a list of your assets, include your house and other properties, your cars, your art, your gold and silver coins, your jewellery and your antiques, which I know I've got a lot of gold and silver coins just hanging about and art. He said, cut out stuff that you don't need. He said, fly in economy instead of premium and sell the barely used sports car that's lurking in your garage. So,
the barely used sports car.
So if you're listening to this at home and you're a bit short, just go in your garage, look at the barely used sports car. Maybe there's some art and gold coins behind it, and you can just sell those and everything will be fine. This is a Brexiteer. We're going to do a big Trump cast next week. The election, touch wood again, fingers crossed, everything crossed. It doesn't look like it's going too well for Donald Trump, apart from if you're a reader of the Daily Express Online. Headlines in the last week have included Joe Biden on the brink as Donald Trump is told he's very likely to win the US election. And Donald Trump backed new polls shows overwhelming support for US president. Sadly for Donald Trump, the news that he's very likely to win the US election turned out to be just an interview with somebody called Sergio Montano, who is the spokesperson for Italy's Brexit Party. And the poll, which showed a staggering Trump lead of 80% to 20% over Joe Biden, was just a poll of about 8,000 readers of express.co.uk who were really unlikely to swing the big vote on November the 3rd because, of course, they all live in the UK and not the US and they can't vote at all. Daniel Hannan is one of the Brexiteers of the week. He's the so-called brain of Brexit, Telegraph columnist. He wrote this week, after 1782, Great Britain recognised the reality of American independence and focused on agreeing strong trading ties with the new state. The EU, sadly, has been unable to make an equivalent psychological adjustment. And it's quite a rewrite of history, isn't it? Because in 1812, Britain was at war with America. We burned down Washington, D.C., including the White House. We tried to invade New York. We tried to invade Maryland. We gave a load of arms to the Native Americans to try and cut off expansion of settlers. And we imposed the Navigation Acts, which meant that the USA couldn't trade with British colonies like they used to be able to trade to. So I'm not sure that that's quite right from Daniel Hannan. Sharks are a Brexiteer of the week.
Ooh. Who's your favourite shark?
It's, well, obviously, the one of the leader of the pathetic sharks in Viz is my...
Yes. Well, I like Sharky from Sharky and George.
Oh, that's good, yeah. Very good. It's claimed that some of the biggest beneficiaries of Brexit will be cold-blooded, dead-eyed, ruthless killers, not Dominic Cummings and Michael Gove. It is Jaws and his pals. The Fisheries Minister, Victoria Prentice, said in the Commons last week that when we leave the EU, it will be able to bring an end to the cruel practice of finning, which is hacking the fins off live sharks, saving them for use in Chinese soups, and then the people throw the fish back overboard and obviously the fish die. Then it's already illegal under EU law, but Prentice says that there are loads of loopholes which make it unenforceable. It sounds like something we would want to stop. And she says we can do that when we join the WTO. The only problem with this, I've discovered, is that if one country in the WTO objects to something that other countries suggest, then it goes. There's a single country veto, and it will remain unfinished, as they say. And as they almost say in the Steven Spielberg classic movie, she's going to need a bigger vote. The Brexiteer of the week this week, though, is Steve Baker, former leader of the ERG, the European Research Group. Remember them, they didn't really like Europe and they didn't seem to do much research. He has now turned his analytical skills to the church. He accused archbishops opposing the internal market bill of sowing division where they might have promoted unity. And he wrote, perhaps the prime minister ought to move to a paving motion on the disestablishment of the Church of England. Well, I mean, thank goodness he's not overreacting. Is this just a ruse? So Jacob Rees-Mogg can say anti-disestablishmentarianism in the House of Commons and then grin like his nanny's special big boy. Is it what the Tories had in mind all along when they talked about using Henry VIII powers? How long is it going to be before Boris Johnson starts shouting, who will rid me of this turbulent priest? And how long will it be, in fact, before Ian Botham is named the new Archbishop of Canterbury? Absolutely absurd war on the church, bashing of the bishops. Steve Baker, Brexiteer of the Week.
Congratulations, Steve. I don't think it's the first time he's been our Brexiteer of the Week, and I doubt it will be.
He seemed to be getting more sensible of late, didn't he, Steve Baker? I think the other week we were saying how sensible he'd been about something, and this is just ludicrous, isn't it?
Strange times. What should the listener do?
People we disagree with. If you enjoyed this podcast, it was very long, but we enjoyed it.
It was.
Please subscribe to us. Leave us a nice review. It really makes a difference. Please buy the new European print edition. £3 in shops now. Two deals for you on the new European website. You can get 13 issues of the print edition for £25. That's a saving of £14. over 6 months. You can get a rolling subscription of £6 a month for 3 months, then £8 a month thereafter. That saves you at least £4 a month.
Do you know what, Steve?
Go on.
That is the same price as Netflix.
Yeah, it's nothing. It's nothing. Get on there. Just go into your garage, sell that old car, get your painting out, your old Picasso that you just threw in there. There's all the gold coins behind it and jewellery. You know, just spend that on the subscription to the New European. Or you can go to tneshop.co.uk, buy a New European face mask. Please join our Facebook readers group. Please follow us on Twitter at The New European. You can also follow me on Twitter at Sanglesey, S-A-N-G-L-E-S-E-Y.
If you'd like to send me Picassos, I can sort you out a subscription. Just tap me up on Twitter. My DMs are open. Is that a thing? I don't even know. You can follow me on Twitter as well.
Andrew Levi's.
No, it's not a Giuliani moment here. I am fully tucked in. You can follow me on Twitter at Porritt, P-O-R-R-I-T-T. This has been a mammoth saga of a podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. We certainly did. Thank you so much to Charlie Connolly, to Matt Withers, to Liz Gerard, and of course to the wonderful Steve Anglesey. We will be back next week. Until then, Mr. Campbell, please play your bagpipes.
Here you go.